You're listening to KORC 105.9 LPFM, Corvallis, Oregon, streaming at korcfm.com.
The views expressed in the following program are those of the writers and producers and do not necessarily reflect the views of KORC, its underwriters, or community airwaves.
Thanks for tuning in to KORC's News, Music, and Civic Show, where a variety of individuals present you with information about Corvallis and the surrounding areas. This is Wendy Byrne, bringing you this week's Corvallis Civics Cafe. Since the last edition of the show, the City Council held two meetings, their Monday night business meeting in Council Chambers at the downtown fire station, and their Thursday afternoon work session at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room. If you are intrigued by the recap I provide today, you can find recordings of all the meetings available in full for your viewing pleasure at vimeo.com/City of Corvallis, as well as via the archives of City Council meetings found on the city's webpage at corvallisoregon.gov. The recordings are frequently available within 24 hours of the conclusion of the meeting. If you are not able to attend in person or watch the live stream of the meeting, you can catch the replay. Last week, I read you an As I See It from the Gazette Times that was written by Mark O'Brien. The title of the piece was, Maybe Corvallis Should Do an Investigation on Itself. If you stay tuned to the end today, I'll be back on that subject with a reading of an editorial piece that the Gazette Times published on February 1st, titled, Process Isn't the Reason Why Corvallis Has to Fork Over $500,000. But that is dessert, and I don't want to get ahead of myself. On Monday, February 3rd, the City Council meeting opened with a full house. Council Chambers was packed full of people in attendance to hear the revisitation of the 18-year-old Cascade Crest subdivision application for development. The short backstory. Cascade Crest was pitched in 2006 as a 10-lot development of single-family homes out Brooklane Drive, on property that is covered in lovely oak trees and has significant slopes in several areas. The original application was denied by the Planning Commission, then passed by the City Council, then appealed to the Land Use Board of Appeals by concerned Corvallis residents. The Land Use Board of Appeals sent the case back to the City of Corvallis with directions to address three areas of concern if the land was going to be developed: what to do about sidewalks, how to manage stormwater runoff, and how to manage the downstream impacts of said stormwater runoff. As if 18 years was not long enough, it took nearly 3 hours for the council to slog their way through this hearing. There was a presentation from staff, followed by a presentation from the applicant, followed by testimony from the public, all of which was against the development. Next, there was extensive Q&A from the council to the applicant and the city staff present. City Attorney Josh Soper was present and available to answer questions and provide feedback and to remind all of us that this very unusual case is before us today because over the past 18 years, the city granted extensions each time the developer asked for one, a situation that is actually now prohibited by state law. And while the City Council did vote 6-3 to grant the development with conditions, concerned members of the public have the right to appeal the decision to the State Land Use Board of Appeals, and they are gearing up to do that very thing. If you are interested in finding out more about that effort, tell the web browser of your choice to find www.spotfund.com, and once there, look for LUBA Appeal Cascade Crest. I'm pretty sure we have not heard the last about this property, and I'm going to do my best to continue to bring you information about it. It was a full meeting on Monday night for council. That same night, they also voted to sunset the Civic Campus Community Engagement Task Force. And here I was, thinking they were going to use that task force to help them move forward to continue to engage the public about their plans to build a civic campus in downtown. Next, they moved to set the stage to hear an appeal, scheduled for early March, about sewer pipe diameters and the impact of same on the cost of developing housing in our fair city. Nearly 4 hours into the meeting, during the section titled Mayor, Council, and City Manager Reports, the mayor accused our local press of being only interested in presenting tabloid-style gotcha journalism and declared the February 1st editorial in the Gazette Times as, quote, full of inaccuracies, unquote. Stay tuned to the end of the program today, and I will read that editorial to you, and we can see if we can determine what he means by that statement. The mayor lamented that there seems to be no local reporting on, quote, the good work being done by city government, unquote. On Thursday, February 5th, the council met in their work session starting at 4 p.m. at the Madison Avenue Meeting Room at 500 Northwest Madison in downtown Corvallis. The meeting opened with a dog and pony show from Republic Services that included a presentation about their efforts to achieve a more sustainable business model. They even brought a high-tech electronic-powered trash truck and invited city council members and the public to tour the truck prior to the meeting. While I find their sustainability goals respectable, it is a guaranteed fact that the only way they are going to achieve their goals is to electrify their fleet of trash trucks. I'm not sure that the city of Corvallis residents should volunteer to pay extra to help Republic Services meet a goal that they should meet, regardless of our franchise fees. I sensed resistance amongst the city councilors to the idea of raising rates for trash service within the city of Corvallis, and I appreciate their skepticism. The next part of the work session was a discussion about what essential principles the city council wants to use to help guide their decisions about how to fund the Civic Administration Building, a new police facility, and how to afford any of the other facility improvements that have been identified as necessary. Going old school, City of Corvallis Director of Finance James Inglis led the council through an exercise using pen and paper on a giant grid. The council decided in a previous meeting that they will hire a consultant to help them determine how best to raise the funds to pay for these projects, but they need to give that consultant some guidelines. Per the staff memo on this exercise, quote, "It is important to remember that the funding analysis guiding principles will be a key marker in how decisions are reached on which sources of revenue to pursue," unquote. I have to admit that this discussion got pretty far into the weeds for me, and I lost track of the thread several times. I will be curious to know how Mr. Inglis brings this back to the council for the next round of conversation about the money talk. For simplicity's sake, the categories I heard mentioned were transparency, revenue generation, adequacy of funds generated, political feasibility, and financial feasibility. If anyone out there listened to the meeting and wants to discuss, please reach out to me at wendy@korcfm.com. Lastly, at the work session, staff presented the council with a 2-year City Council reference tool. Essentially, this is an outline of what conversations can be expected on what topics during what part of the 2 years of the City Council's term. This is a useful tool for the council, for staff, and even for members of the public who are curious to know when to expect what topics to come up for discussion. For example, the city budget is discussed and adopted in May of this year, and Budget Commission meetings start in March. The city also starts discussions about its capital improvement program in March, and decisions about this have an impact on the budget. These items and more are organized in the document that was presented to the council at this meeting. It's a funny thing. I ran a word search on the document, and I did not find an entry that had to deal with a review of the city charter, which I thought was going to be prioritized this year. I'm going to have to keep an eye on that, because didn't we recently learn that part of our city charter was deemed unconstitutional? And shouldn't we get around to changing that sooner rather than later? That's the news from the City Council this past week, and I think I promised you some dessert. And the dessert on the menu today is a piece of spice cake. This spice cake is an editorial that was printed in the Corvallis Gazette Times on February 1st. The editorial board of the Corvallis Gazette Times is made up of Penny Rosenberg, Steve Gress, and Les Garrett. The editorial is titled, "Don't Blame the Process for Decision." In the same season, Corvallis leaders are considering how to raise $189 million for a new city hall and police station. They also have to shell out what looks to be around $500,000 of taxpayers' hard-earned money for attorney's fees. That's for their lawyers and Councillor Charlene Ellis's after she successfully sued to stop the city from forcing her out of office. Prevailing plaintiffs in civil rights cases are often paid by the non-prevailing government entity, and boy, did Corvallis not prevail. Federal Judge Ann Aiken found Ellis's attorney persuasive on almost all points, saying she didn't have to examine the city's underlying arguments because the city charter, a document that acts similarly to a country's or state's constitution, was unconstitutional on its face, contradicting both the Oregon and the U.S. constitutions. We'd say they played a bad hand poorly, but that trivializes the sheer boneheadedness of city leadership. Not only does the attempt to oust Ellis likely hinder future efforts to raise money for facilities, it also tarnishes the city's reputation. We're pretty sure no one wanted this to be the statewide hot goss coming out of Corvallis. And perhaps equally bad, in the aftermath, Corvallis is doing Corvallis things, and it's kind of embarrassing. First, let's recap. City leadership, which appears to be City Manager Mark Shepard, then Attorney Jim Brewer, Mayor Charles Mon, and then Council President Tracy Yee, alleged Ellis in September 2023 violated the city's charter by interfering with the city manager's duties when she suggested the council should direct him to fill a city hall position. It was one that had gone vacant months before, i.e., when the city council already had budgeted. The aforementioned foursome confronted Ellis in November 2023, and a resolution proposed on the next council meeting agenda would have declared her seat forfeited, the consequences for such an egregious political sin. But as we have said before, Ellis wasn't recommending any particular person. There was no nepotism, no quid pro quo, bribe, undue influence, or coercion, which are the types of activities you would suspect might lead to the effort to oust a counselor. The resolution was postponed, a due process hearing was planned, and then postponed, and ultimately Ellis sued, saying the charter's clause in question violated her free speech rights. Anywhere along the way, the city could have changed course. Ellis just wanted to keep her job. In winning her case, she only asked for nominal damages. The judge awarded her $1. But the city is now on the hook for her attorney's fees, which will likely cost around $200,000. And the city also has its own legal bills, and based on previous reporting, we're guesstimating that at $300,000. $500,000? Half a mil? For not dropping the forfeiture attempt. That's extremely expensive egg on their faces. It also comes after Ward 5 residents declined to challenge Ellis, who ran unopposed for re-election on the November 5 ballot. You'd think that when the filing period closed last August, the city would have dropped the matter, or at least on November 6th. Sure, it still would have incurred a massive legal bill, but there's at least $200,000 in savings right there to not have to pay Ellis's lawyer. So, we're basically caught up. Now, having been unable thus far to tell their side of the dispute, the city is planning to spend more taxpayers' money to post on its website an explainer of why leadership did what they did, according to Mayor Charles Mon. Except Mon, as one of the four who confronted Ellis in November 2023, would probably object to that phrasing, because he asserted the effort was immaculately, or at least spontaneously, conceived. It wasn't city leadership. There's no there there. Quote, "We want to make sure everybody understands that it wasn't an attack and it wasn't malintent," unquote, Mon told reporter Ella Hutcherson. Quote, "It's just that there are certain processes that get triggered by certain things," unquote. We know that local policy wonks like to say, in Corvallis, the process is the product, alluding to the vast number of commissions, boards, task forces, public outreach meetings that often occur before anything tangible comes before the city council. But really, Mr. Mayor, the attempt to remove Ellis from office was simply a mechanical process that had a life of its own? City leadership was compelled to confront Ellis? The resolution just magically appeared on the agenda? The city had to hire expensive outside counsel to defend the lawsuit rather than settle? They couldn't have dropped it after the election? No one had free will? A city with one of the most educated populaces in the entire country is supposed to buy that? Also, the idea of the city offering its take after the fact is laughable. As resident Tim Roach noted in a recent letter to the editor, it flies in the face of Winston Churchill's astute observation that history is written by the victors. And maybe the losers should be able to tell their side, but unless this telling is accompanied by a huge slice of humble pie, don't bother. The whole Ellis affair was a horrible miscalculation by people. We invite the city council to keep those people accountable. Don't let them sani-wash this clean. They've done the city dirty. That was Wendy Byrne reading the February 1st editorial from the Gazette Times, titled, "Don't Blame the Process for the Decision." I think I can understand the mayor's distress at the way this editorial was written, because it points out that many of us members of the public are dissatisfied with the thought that the city is going to post information to a web page to explain to us and educate us about what has happened during this process. I think it might make more sense for the city to release the case files and allow the educated public to come to its own conclusion. It will be interesting to see what happens, and I'm going to keep reporting on it for you right here on KORC's Civics Cafe. If you have any comments or questions about the material I've shared, send me an email at wendy@korcfm.com. And if you have feedback for KORC's News, Music, and Civics, email us at news@korcfm.com. Until next time, again, this is Wendy Byrne for Civics Cafe. The show is heard on Sundays from 1 to 2, on Mondays from 5 to 6, and repeats on Tuesday mornings at 10 a.m. following the many moods of Ben Vaughn here on KORC.
It would distress us to ignore some recent developments in the local billboard industry of Corvallis, our home. On Highway 99 between downtown and Circle Boulevard, just east of 9th Street, are two billboards, both of which recently hosted ads by organizations with right-wing and imperial political agendas. One, for the touring dance group Shen Yun, was recently taken down, while the other, a collab between Jew Belong and the Philos Project, remains. Here's a bit of info on Shen Yun, the Falun Gong, Jew Belong, and the Philos Project. You may have seen ads for the Shen Yun Performing Arts Organization around town or on this billboard, and that was established in New York in 2006. The Shen Yun dance troupe includes dancers and a full orchestra, and they bill themselves as bringing you the experience of China before communism, in a life-changing experience connecting heaven and earth with explosive athleticism. What they don't mention is their parent organization, the Falun Gong, which was founded in the 1990s and has been described as a right-wing cult that's racist, homophobic, and anti-science. While their strong anti-communist message resounds with some Americans, many don't realize that the Falun Gong's moral philosophy is entwined with anti-evolution, disapproval of interracial relationships, and a condemnation of homosexuality and the belief that aliens are trying to control humans by making them believe in modern science. Falun Gong has become a vocal advocate of right-wing politics. They founded the conservative news publication The Epoch Times, that's E-P-O-C-H Times, which passionately supported Trump's 2016 run and presidency, embracing QAnon and believing that Trump was sent by heaven to, quote, destroy the Communist Party. Furthermore, on February 6, 2025, federal authorities from the Department of Homeland Security, the State Department, and federal prosecutors in Manhattan announced they're conducting a criminal investigation into Shen Yun, which is focusing in part on a possible visa fraud. Last year, New York Times investigation revealed that Shen Yun has exploited young performers, typically the children of Falun Gong followers, by paying them little or nothing to work long hours and keep grueling schedules. If you're just tuning in to KORC News, Music, and Civics, we're just providing some background information on a couple of the organizations which have rented billboard space here in Corvallis, one of which is Shen Yun. One past performer of Shen Yun has filed a lawsuit accusing them of forced labor and human trafficking, while other past performers allege that they were not supposed to speak to one another unless it was necessary for work, and dating required permission from Shen Yun's leaders. Violators of these rules could face public shaming during group critique sessions or expulsion from the group. Yuan Chen, a representative for Shen Yun, has said that the group holds on to students' passports for safekeeping, but, quote, we always return the passports when requested, unquote. Representatives of Shen Yun and Falun Gong have stated that state and federal labor laws do not apply to their student performers because they're receiving a learning opportunity, not working as employees. For reference, Shen Yun is currently touring across five continents, and a tax filing in 2023 reported over $266 million in assets, nearly all of which are kept in cash and other liquid assets. Meanwhile, the CFO for the Epoch Times, an outlet run by the Falun Gong practitioners, has been indicted on charges of conspiring to launder $67 million and lying to a bank about its source. And between 2020 and 2021, the period when the money laundering scheme was underway, the Epoch Times donated $16 million to Shen Yun. Another billboard on Highway 99, visible in the southbound direction from Circle Boulevard, is located within the property boundaries of Spaeth Lumber. An employee at Spaeth told KORC that they do not own, control, or profit from this billboard in any way and are not associated with its contents. Similarly, the city of Corvallis informed us that they too have nothing to do with the billboard, which appears to be owned by a multi-billion-dollar international marketing company called Outfront. This billboard features an ad by a group called Jew Belong, which has been criticized for extreme Zionism, anti-Palestinian, and Islamophobic rhetoric. The billboard reads, "Dear colleges, American kids are afraid, do your job," ostensibly referring to anti-Semitism on U.S. college campuses. Without trivializing the real threat of anti-Semitism, and for what it's worth, I'll add that the voice you're hearing now is from a Jewish person who's proud of Corvallis' resilient and supportive community. We must raise the possibility, and with evidence, that Jew Belong was implying something specific with this message, namely that student protesters of U.S. military aid to the State of Israel and advocates for the human rights of Palestinians in the wake of their U.S.-backed genocide should be punished by their colleges. Jew Belong is vocal in their support for the State of Israel's neocolonial Zionist project and is deeply committed to the U.S.'s imperialist foreign policy which enables it. On social media, their founder, Archie Gottsman, a Manhattan storage unit heiress, has posted things like, quote, "Gaza is full of monsters. Burn the whole place. Won't matter. The UN will just give another meaningless sanction," unquote. Referring to Muslim headscarves, another social media post from Jew Belong stated, quote, "A keffiyeh on an American college campus is just a hipster swastika," unquote. KORC reminds listeners that in November 2024, a United Nations special committee found Israel's warfare methods in Gaza consistent with genocide. This is along with Amnesty International, the International Federation for Human Rights, and the governments of over 35 nations. Furthermore, reports from Israeli whistleblowers contend that the IDF and top Israeli intelligence officials had precise foreknowledge of Hamas's plan for October 7th that was apparently ignored. Jew Belong's billboard ad was also brought in part by another organization. The Philos Project was launched in 2014 with support from right-wing pro-Israel donors to, quote, "promote positive Christian engagement in the Middle East," unquote. Recently, on October 7th, 2024, Philos Project hosted a rally for then-candidate J.D. Vance in his support for Donald Trump's latest presidential race, and historically their advocacy for Christian initiatives is laced with its promotion of hawkish U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. If you're just tuning in to KORC News, Music, and Civics, we're presenting a report on several billboards which were visible recently on Highway 99, one of which was funded by the Philos Project. Currently, a May 2024 article on their website titled, "Want to be a pro-Palestinian? Don't support the demonstrations on U.S. campuses," falsely claims that such demonstrations are in explicit support of Hamas and terrorism. This is an organization that was recently awarded $9.4 million from the National Philanthropic Trust, a public charity. Last year, on a pro-life podcast, founder of the Philos Project, Robert Nicholson, claimed that Hamas terrorists were flowing through the U.S. southern border, while last year their executive director, Luke Moon, posted a photo of himself in Israel signing a U.S.-made bomb. Moon has also spoken at events by right-wing groups of the MAGA variety, including the Heritage Foundation, the America First Policy Institute, the Concerned Women of America, and the Christian Right Family Research Council. Philo's project partnered with Christian Zionist leader and former Republican representative from Iowa, Michelle Bachmann, to create the Conference of Presidents of Christian Organizations in Support of Israel. Bachmann has said of Palestinians, quote, they need to be removed from that land. That land needs to be turned into a national park, unquote. It's safe to say that the Philo's Project and Jew Belong have ulterior motives in their effort to seem like righteous defenders of justice and peace, spending their millions on edgy, hot pink billboards and arena-sized circle jerks for MAGA politicians and conservative think tanks, when in reality they lie at a nexus of political influence and imperialistic, indeed genocidal, U.S. foreign policy, which seeks to extend the will of the wealthy and powerful across our political theater and down to our neighborhoods, our phones and laptops and televisions, and even blocking our skies with 1,000 square feet of prime advertising space. While a simple drive across our town can often be a mindless transit, filled with the same scenes of life here, if you care to look or dare to look between the lines, there are powerful moneyed interests working to keep our eyes fixated on certain ideas about our nation and our world. This has been a report by KORC on the Shen Yun and Philo's Project billboards, which were recently displayed on southbound Highway 99. You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics on 105.9 FM, streaming worldwide at korcfm.com.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. I'm Augie West. Let's take a quick break from the news and check out the new single by Elise Tyler, a singer-songwriter out of Silverton, Oregon. She's been doing live shows throughout the Willamette Valley for years. She and her band are releasing a new single on Valentine's Day entitled Satisfaction. Let's take a listen.
Thank you.
That was Elise Tyler's new single, Satisfaction, available February 14th on most music streaming platforms. For booking and media inquiries, contact booking at elisetyler.com.
This is KORC, News, Music, and Civics. The following is an excerpt from Democracy Now!, which aired on Friday, February 7, 2025. For more information on national and international news, visit democracynow.org. This is KORC.
Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump's imposed sanctions on the International Criminal Court over its war crimes investigations against Israel. The executive order issued Thursday accuses the ICC of engaging in, quote, illegitimate and baseless actions targeting America and our close ally Israel, unquote. It also says the ICC abused its power when it issued, quote, baseless arrest warrants for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and former Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant over war crimes and crimes against humanity, reiterating, quote, the ICC has no jurisdiction over the United States or Israel, unquote. Trump's action coincided with Netanyahu's visit to Capitol Hill Thursday, where he met with leaders of both parties. Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson said he was caught off guard by Trump's proposal and was awaiting details, but nonetheless praised it.
Look, there'll be more details forthcoming on that, of course. The initial announcement yesterday, I think, was greeted by surprise by many, but cheered by, I think, people all around the world. Why? Because that area is so dangerous, and he's taking bold, decisive action to try to ensure the peace of that region.
Human rights groups and many world leaders have condemned the United States for welcoming Netanyahu and refusing to serve the ICC arrest warrant against him. Reed Brody is a veteran war crimes prosecutor.
Well, of course, this decision was expected, but nevertheless, it's really threatens to undermine international accountability for the worst crimes and deprive victims all across the globe of justice. This executive order puts the United States on the side of war criminals at the expense of victims of grave crimes seeking justice.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu gifted Trump a golden pager during their meeting at the White House, referencing Israel's deadly booby trap attacks on Lebanon in September, which killed dozens of people and injured thousands more when thousands of pagers blew up at the same time. President Trump is doubling down on his proposal for the United States to seize Gaza, saying the besieged territory would be, quote, turned over to the U.S. by Israel after it concludes its war. Trump made the remarks on Truth Social, writing, quote, the Palestinians would have already been resettled in far safer and more beautiful communities with new and modern homes in the region. They would actually have a chance to be happy, safe, and free. No soldiers by the U.S. would be needed, unquote, Trump wrote. The Wall Street Journal reported Pentagon officials have received no formal request to draft a plan for U.S. troop deployment to Gaza. Meanwhile, even some Republicans have come out in opposition, including Senator Lindsey Graham, who said other Senate Republicans oppose sending U.S. troops to Gaza. Residents of Gaza compared Trump's plan to the 1948 Nakba and the violent displacement of Palestinians from their land over the past decades.
I believe that this plan is destined to fail. Why? Because since the occupation of Palestine in 1948, this project has been proposed by occupiers and nations that support occupation regarding the issue of displacing the population of the Gaza Strip, but failed due to the steadfastness of our people in the face of this decision. Of course, the occupation will also fail in this war of extermination that began on October 7th, 2023.
Israel continues to violate violate the ceasefire agreement as Israeli soldiers shot dead two Palestinians, including a child in southern Gaza on Wednesday. The White House says President Trump plans to keep only 294 staff at the U.S. Agency for International Development out of the agency's total of over 10,000 workers around the world, cutting the staff by about 97%. The remaining USAID workers would include just 12 in the Africa Bureau, 8 in the Asia Bureau. This comes after Trump earlier this week ordered nearly the entire USAID staff to be placed on administrative leave beginning today and ordered thousands of personnel working overseas to return to the U.S. to the U.S. USAID distributed nearly $44 billion in aid during fiscal year 2023. About three of every five foreign assistance dollars worldwide. The Senate's voted 53-47 along party lines to confirm Russell Vogt, head of the Office of Management and Budget. Vogt is an architect of Project 2025, a radical playbook to seize executive power and to radically reshape federal agencies. Last year, Vogt told undercover reporters his plans for mass deportations, restricting abortion, gutting independent government bureaucracies, and using the military against racial justice protesters. Vogt also said he would work to paint federal workers as villains and, quote, put them in trauma in order to drastically reduce the size of the federal civilian workforce. This is Democratic Senator Angela Alsobrooks of Maryland, who represents over 150,000 federal workers.
They are public servants in the truest sense of the word, who are not guided by party, not moved by vicious news cycles, but they are driven instead by mission. A mission to serve this country to the very best of their ability, under any president of any party. And in just 17 days, this president has put all of their livelihoods on the line. How shameless, how reckless, how callous, how depraved.
On Thursday, a federal judge temporarily blocked the Trump administration's so-called deferred resignation program, offering 8 months' pay and salary to any government worker replying to a mass email sent out by Elon Musk's Doge operation. The judge will revisit the case Monday. The Wall Street Journal reports 25-year-old Doge staff member Marco Elles, who gained access to the Treasury Department's central payment system, resigned Thursday after he was linked to a deleted social media account that advocated racism and eugenics and said, "Normalize Indian hate." In another apparent breach of sensitive data, CNN reports Energy Secretary Chris Wright granted a 23-year-old former SpaceX intern and Doge staffer access to the Energy Department's IT system. On his social media site X, Elon Musk has threatened reprisals, including journalists, after Wired magazine named six of his young associates at Doge who are between the ages of 19 and 26. Meanwhile, the White House is preparing an executive order to cut thousands of jobs at the Department of Health and Human Services, including positions at the CDC and FDA. This comes after as several dairy herds in Nevada have just tested positive for a new variant of the H5N1 bird flu virus, raising fresh concerns of a spillover into human populations and a new pandemic. More than 1,000 people gathered for a protest outside the Treasury Department in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday afternoon, denouncing what they called a breach of secure information by Elon Musk and his young associates. The protest came as the Trump administration said it would close the Environmental Protection Agency's Environmental Justice Office and place 168 workers on leave. Meanwhile, lawmakers, including Arizona Congress member Yasemin Ansari, were denied access as they tried to enter the EPA's headquarters Thursday.
In Phoenix, last year we saw 143 days above 100-degree temperatures. Hundreds of people die on our streets every summer as a result of extreme heat. We also have some of the worst air pollution in the country that we're working to combat. And these attacks on the Environmental Protection Agency cannot stand.
In more Trump cabinet news, the Senate voted 55-44 Wednesday to confirm Scott Turner as Department of Housing and Urban Development Secretary, despite concerns his FBI background check had not been completed. Turner is a former developer and NFL player who's expected to slash the department's multi-billion dollar budget and overhaul affordable housing vouchers as well as programs for unhoused people. Turner's the only African-American member of Trump's cabinet. President Trump's nominated retired Brigadier General Anthony J. Tata, known for his history of Islamophobic and other racist remarks, to a senior Pentagon post charged with overseeing deployments. Tata once called President Obama a terrorist leader. This comes as the Trump administration on Tuesday evicted former Coast Guard Commandant Linda Fagan from her home with 3 hours' notice, without enough time to even gather her personal belongings. She's a four-star admiral and the first woman to lead a branch of the military. She was removed from her post on Trump's second day in office. Homeland Security Department officials cited Fagan's, quote, excessive focus on DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. The Education Department has announced investigations against two universities and a high school sports league for allowing transgender athletes to compete in women's sports. The agency, which Trump has vowed to dismantle, will be probing the University of Pennsylvania and San Jose State University, claiming the institutions have violated civil rights laws over their policies supporting trans athletes in college teams. Meanwhile, trans rights activists are condemning the National Collegiate Athletic Association after its board voted to ban trans women from sports, caving to Trump's executive order, which directs federal agencies to withhold funding for schools that do not comply. The World Meteorological Organization reports January was the warmest since records began, reaching 1.75 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. The January data was a surprise to many scientists, coming despite La Nina conditions that tend to cool the globe. On Sunday, temperatures at the North Pole soared above the freezing point of ice, reaching 36 degrees Fahrenheit above normal for the date. This week, staffers with Elon Musk's DOGE operation entered the headquarters of NOAA. That's the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, to access IT systems. They're also reviewing the agency's diversity, equity, and inclusion practices. NOAA's National Marine Fisheries Service has ordered its scientists to stop all contact with foreign colleagues and contacts, including on international treaties and seafood catch limits. Meanwhile, President Trump has nominated Neil Jacobs to reprise his role as acting administrator of NOAA. An investigation found Jacobs violated NOAA's code of ethics in 2019 after defending Trump's false claim that Hurricane Dorian would hit Alabama, the so-called Sharpiegate scandal. The California Public Utilities Commission has received video and data evidence strongly suggesting high-voltage transmission lines operated by the electric power company Southern California Edison were responsible for igniting the Eaton Fire, which killed 17 people last month as it swept through the historically black neighborhood of Altadena, destroying 9,400 homes, schools, businesses, and other structures. On Thursday, mourners gathered at First AME Church of Pasadena for a memorial service honoring fire victims. Community members and civil rights leaders are demanding the same federal resources for recovery that LA's most affluent neighborhoods are receiving. They're also warning against shortchanging by insurance companies. Joining the call is Zaire Calvin, who became separated from his sister, Evelyn McClendo, on January 9th as he evacuated the fire with his baby and elderly mother. He returned to find his sister's remains in the rubble of her home.
We want to be made whole. Black people always end up last. I'm just going to say it now. Yes, sir. Yeah. We always end up last. Can we just be first in line in this?
This week, the insurance giant State Farm has asked California regulators to approve a rate hike that would see the average homeowner pay 22% more for their premiums. In 2023, State Farm said it would no longer accept new applications for property insurance in California. And last year, it cut 72,000 home and apartment policies across California, citing inflation and, quote, catastrophe exposure. And in India, lawmakers held a protest outside the parliament Thursday, outraged by reports that some 100 Indian immigrants from the United States were kept in shackles during a 40-hour U.S. deportation flight back to India, including during bathroom breaks. This comes days before Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi is expected to meet President Trump at the White House. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
That was an excerpt from Democracy Now!, which aired on Friday, February 7th, 2025. For more information on national and international news, visit democracynow.org. This is KORC, News, Music, and Civics.
The following is a statement from the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality, or DEQ. DEQ's role in response to the January 4th train derailment in Corvallis was to provide support to the railroad and their contractors as they worked to determine how to remove the pelletized urea fertilizer from the rail cars and extract the rail cars from the Marys River in a way that minimized environmental impact. It took nearly a week to remove the rail cars and mitigate the risk to the river's water quality. Each rail car was loaded with 100,000 pounds of fertilizer. One car was fully submerged in the water and another was partially submerged. Since the rail cars have two sections, 150,000 pounds of fertilizer entered the river in total. The trestle collapse occurred half a mile upstream of the confluence of the Marys and Willamette Rivers. While farmers commonly apply this fertilizer on fields, the concern was the large amount that had entered the river. DEQ requested contractors to take water samples upstream and downstream of the trestle collapse to evaluate water quality, specifically for ammonia, which is created when urea combines with water. It may also lead to the creation of nitrate and nitrite. Samples were collected upstream and downstream at six total locations. Samples for ammonia were collected daily from January 4th to January 12th. Samples for nitrate and nitrite were collected daily from January 9th to January 12th. Ammonia is a concern for fish and aquatic life. Nitrogen compounds are a concern for human health. There was no immediate or acute threat to fish and wildlife based on the sampling data. Likewise, sampling found low levels of the nitrogen compounds. Flow conditions in the Marys River at the time of the incident were relatively high, above 1,800 cubic feet per second. The high flows likely contributed to the comparatively low values of ammonia and nitrogen compounds reported in the sampling data. DEQ concluded its emergency response on January 10th once the contents of the rail cars in the river and hanging over the river had been pumped out or dissolved. DEQ's water quality program requested two more days of sampling to confirm low levels of ammonia and the two nitrogen compounds in the river. This was a statement from the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics.
You're listening to KORC News, Music, and Civics. The following is a story from the Corvallis Gazette-Times that was published on February 6, 2025 by Shayla Escudero. Headline: Samaritan makes cuts to DEI department. Samaritan Health Services is making changes to its diversity, equity, and inclusion department amid financial shortfalls that have spurred the elimination of positions. Both the DEI manager and well-being program coordinator roles were eliminated last month in an effort to make up for a multi-million dollar deficit. The timing of the news follows federal efforts by the Trump administration to slash federal DEI efforts. However, Samaritan officials say the timing is coincidental and that despite the cuts, their commitment to inclusion will endure in a more streamlined effort. Samaritan Regional Medical Center in Corvallis and Albany General Hospital are typically operated at a financial deficit or, at best, just breaking even, according to filings with the Oregon Health Authority. Hospital audit records indicate that Corvallis Regional Medical Center's first two quarters in 2024 operated at a nearly $8 million deficit. In 2023, the hospital was over $28 million in deficit, and the previous year topped $25 million. Albany General Hospital operated at a $4 million deficit for the first half of 2024 and broke even in 2023. The year before that, it experienced a $6 million deficit. However, Samaritan's other three small hospitals, including Samaritan Lebanon Community Hospital, make up for these losses. When accounting revenue and operating expenses, the Lebanon Hospital had a positive margin of $10 million for the first half of 2024. Both the DEI manager and well-being program coordinator roles were eliminated, according to a January 23rd email distributed to staff. The action was prompted by the aforementioned financial deficits, according to an email Samaritan sent to Mid Valley Media, though the healthcare system did not specify which positions had been cut or how many were eliminated. As you are aware, this past fall, to recover and maintain financial stability with the least impact on patient care, several financial measures were put in place, including expense control, project delays, and staffing adjustments, Public Information Officer Mark Yellen wrote in an email. The decisions were not made lightly, but we are committed to continuing our mission and providing care for people in our communities, he said. The two DEI positions were eliminated, leaving the DEI coordinator to report to the Director of Fitness and Well-Being, according to the January 23rd email from Chief Administrative Officer Kelly Kaiser to staff. In alignment with our mission and values, this work continues to be core to Samaritan and is not going away, Kaiser wrote. The change was an opportunity to streamline efforts by weaving together two once separate departments that in some cases had overlapping work, according to a Samaritan statement. The new department will initially be made up of a well-being director and a DEI program coordinator. During this transition period, planned DEI and well-being efforts will continue, including a joint DEI training session for both councils. Once the integration is complete, we'll have a new roadmap for advancing initiatives focused on equity and belonging, the statement read. The news of Samaritan's consolidation of the DEI department came on the coattails of substantial efforts to remove DEI at a federal level. On January 21st, President Donald Trump directed all federal DEI workers to be put on leave. That move came after his first day in office, when he signed an executive order that called for the dismantling of diversity and inclusion programs. Only 2 days after that news, Samaritan announced its own efforts to consolidate the DEI department. However, the health system characterized the timing as an unfortunate coincidence. While the announcement of this new strategy was unfortunate given the federal government's recent actions, Samaritan's commitment to diversity, equity, and inclusion has not wavered and remains essential to our mission of building healthier communities together. That was an article from the Corvallis Gazette Times, authored by Shayla Esquerdo, from February 6, 2025. The next article is from the Corvallis Gazette Times, dated February 5th, 2025, is authored by Ella Hutcherson and the headline reads, Corvallis settles Ellis case to the tune of $200,000. The city of Corvallis has reached a settlement agreement with Councillor Charlene Ellis in the amount of $200,000 as the Ellis versus Corvallis lawsuit comes to a close. Of the $200,000 awarded, $1 in damages will go to Ellis herself. The rest goes to attorney's fees and costs, which will be divvied up between Ellis's primary attorney, Jesse Buss, and his co-counsel, Tom Christ. This outcome was anticipated. According to Buss, prevailing plaintiffs in civil rights cases are often paid by the non-prevailing government entity. These costs are separate from the city's own legal bills. As of October 2024, the city had spent $260,000 on the case. I do believe the settlement was fair, Ellis told Mid Valley Media via email. Ellis sued the city last January, seeking to halt a process that would see her removed from office. A proposed resolution introduced in December 2023 had accused her of violating the city charter when she made a motion at a city council meeting 3 months prior, asking the city manager to fill a vacancy at City Hall. 1 year later, a federal judge has ruled that the city of Corvallis's attempt to oust Ellis void and the section of the city's charter leveled against her unconstitutional because it violated her free speech rights. The city will not seek an appeal. Given the political situation at the federal level, I am grateful that the judge supported free speech at the days, Ellis wrote. We cannot have elected officials or community members who are afraid to speak up for fear of retaliation. We all have a voice and a vote, she continued. If we do not use both, democracy dies. According to City Manager Mark Shepard, just under half of the settlement cost to Ellis's attorney was covered by CIS Oregon, which insures Corvallis. The city paid the other half of the insurance company as part of its deductible. This amount came from the city council's budget, Shepard said, which has a line item for legal fees. This budget was created with some contingency for the cost of new attorneys, which the city transitioned to in February 2024, so no budgetary tweaks were necessary when paying the CIS deductible, he said. That was an article from the Corvallis Gazette Times dated February 5th, 2025. Article was authored by Ella Hutcherson. You're listening to KORC, News, Music, and Civics.
Think about your mother, your sister, your girlfriend. One in six women is a victim of sexual assault. Now think about your father, your brother, your best friend. Men are victims too. Rape can happen to anyone. This is Christina Ricci with RAIN, encouraging you to call the National Sexual Assault Hotline to learn how to support someone you love. Call 1-800-656-HOPE or visit RAIN.org. That's RAIN.org.
Brought to you by RAIN and this station.